For KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. We're here every 6:30 to every Friday from 6:30 to 7 here on KPFK 90.7 in LA. That's 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, and 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Of course, we're also streaming live worldwide at kpfk.org. If you go to my archive at scotthortonshow.com, you will find more than 1,800 interviews going back to really the day of the fall of Baghdad, April 9th, 2003. And you'll also find that more than 100 of those 1,800 are of Dr. Gareth Porter, independent historian and journalist for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. And we reprint just about everything he writes for IPS and everything else, too, at antiwar.com/Porter. And he's got two very important pieces this week I think are worth your consideration. And so I'm happy to welcome Gareth to the show right now. How's it going, Gareth?
Fine. Thanks very much for having me on the show again, Scott. Good to be here.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here. Let's start with Pakistan. Your most recent piece is called Pakistan Moves to Curb More Aggressive Drone Strikes and Spying. And this has at least something to do with the reaction to the case of Raymond Davis, the CIA agent or asset who killed a couple of people and then bribed his way to freedom a couple of weeks back. So go ahead and tell us about what more aggressive drone strikes and spying, and then a bit about the expulsions and the reaction to it this week in Pakistan.
Right. Just to sort of begin with the issue that you just raised about Raymond Davis, the CIA contract spy, basically, who was arrested after killing two, actually responsible for the deaths of three Pakistanis in January. I think the point that I wanted to make in this story is that although that was the occasion for the Pakistanis to start taking a much stronger view, much stronger attitude towards the U.S. military campaign through drone strikes, as well as the increase in the number of spies, it was really more an opportunity for them to raise these issues than the reason for it. In other words, it was a symbol of some underlying problems that had really, from the Pakistani point of view, and I think objectively speaking, had gotten out of control. That is to say, the drone strikes by the United States and the use of spies, particularly unilateral intelligence agents, that is, agents which were not being made known to the Pakistanis and thus were operating without the Pakistanis' knowledge in Pakistan. Those two problems, from the Pakistani military leadership's point of view, had really gotten out of control. And the point that I want to make is that the Pakistanis had indeed agreed to both the drone war in Pakistan and to a number of U.S. intelligence specialists, both military and civilian, operating within Pakistan under the Musharraf regime. And that agreement had continued during the post-Musharraf regime. To some degree, the Pakistanis, when they did sort of publicly complain on occasion about drone strikes, they were being hypocritical. I mean, they were really sort of privately going along with it while publicly complaining in order to play to their domestic audience. But I think now it's very clear that this has changed, and that's what my story is about, that this issues of drone strikes and spies in Pakistan have now gotten to the point where the Pakistanis realize that what they had originally agreed to is no longer what they're dealing with. It's a much more serious set of U.S. activities that leave the Pakistani government and military much more vulnerable politically than was the case earlier on.
Mm-hmm. Well, so when Obama came in, he made no secret of the fact that he wanted to expand the war in Pakistan and increase the number of drone strikes, that kind of thing. McCain even chastised him during the campaign for, and I think Hillary Clinton did too, for stating too plainly that he wanted to escalate the war there. And so I guess, you know, you're saying the Zardari government has gone along with that, but only to a certain degree. I wonder, why is it that the Obama team had to escalate the number of covert operatives, CIA and JSOC types, and I guess probably Blackwater and whoever else there, increase the number of drone strikes beyond what they had an agreement with the Pakistani government? Because it seems like now they just blew it and caused a reaction.
That is indeed a very important issue. Let's start with the drone strike program, the drone war, if you will. This is a policy that was begun in 2004 under the Bush administration. And at that point, it was targeted at high-level al-Qaeda leaders. And in that regard, it was certainly something that the Pakistanis felt was justified, and they felt that it was in their interest. Because at that point, the al-Qaeda folks in 2004-2005, al-Qaeda in Pakistan was linking up with the extreme sort of religious extremists who were increasingly calling for violence against the Pakistani government and military. But what has happened since 2004-2005 is that that program has followed a certain sort of bureaucratic logic where the CIA, Operations Directorate, which is in charge of it, has sought to increase the level of the scope of the drone strikes. Like any good bureaucracy, they want to grow, they want to have more money, they want to have more staff, and they want to have more activities. And in this case, what that meant was getting the Bush administration to agree to a much longer, larger target list of not just high-ranking al-Qaeda people and not even al-Qaeda people in general, but anybody in Pakistan who could be regarded as somehow related to al-Qaeda, allied with al-Qaeda, or affiliated with al-Qaeda, and not just the leaders of those organizations, but the rank and file as well. And so you have...
Well, and anyone who is on the Pakistani side of the line who's deemed to be helping the Afghan insurgency, whether related to Arab Afghans or not, right?
Exactly. This is one of the major developments which has come particularly since the Bush administration. I just wanted to fill in the background of this, which is that the CIA got George W. Bush to agree to a huge increase in the size of the target list, the length of the target list. But when Obama came in, the target list became even wider. And what happened was then the United States increasingly the CIA began to target anyone who was involved with or allied with the Afghan Taliban, who took, went on the Pakistani side of the border and found a place for rest and recreation, and a place to be rearmed and to go back to fight in Afghanistan. So, in other words, this became a new front in the war in Afghanistan. And thus, what happened was that the drone war was increasingly, in fact, a real war, not just individuals being targeted, but basically whole populations in parts of the tribal area northwest of Pakistan. So this became a much bigger war and a much bigger issue for the Pakistani military. Then that began to really create some tension between the Pakistanis and the Americans because, as you well know, the Pakistani military and intelligence services and then the Pakistani government generally does in fact support the Afghan Taliban as a movement and an army that really represents Pakistani interests in the context of the Afghanistan war. And so that was one of the reasons why the Pakistanis became increasingly alarmed about the drone war. But I think even more important than that is the fact that the drone war has now come to kill so many civilians, so many people who are not holding offices in any jihadist organization of any kind, that it was becoming clear to the Pakistanis that this was a provocation to the population and to the tribal leadership in the Fatah region in northwest Pakistan, and that it was going to cause them very, very great problems of increased opposition to the Pakistani military. So I think that's the fundamental reason why they have finally come around to saying enough is enough. We have to do something about this.
Mm-hmm. And now who all's been kicked out and how many? And okay. What effect is that going to have, say, for example, on the effort against the insurgents in Afghanistan?
Well, with regard to the espionage presence of the United States, both civilian and military, what has happened is that the United States, over the past several months, this is going back to mid to late last year, the United States has increased the number of spies in Pakistan enormously. According to the New York Times story, the Pakistanis are saying they want 25% to 40% of the total number of spies the United States has now placed in Pakistan to be removed, to be withdrawn. And they're saying that that represents a few hundred, perhaps 300. So that means that the total number of spies that the United States has infiltrated into Pakistan has grown to more than 1,300. So this is really it's quite an army of U.S. spies, and a very large number of those, it turns out, were infiltrated without the knowledge of the Pakistanis, meaning that the United States has unilateral spies treating the Pakistani government and military essentially as an enemy rather than as an ally. So this has caused a great deal of difficulty with the Pakistanis, in part because the spies are being used for a couple of purposes. One, of course, as you've suggested, has to do with the Afghan Taliban, and so it works at cross purposes with the Pakistani interest. The other one, purpose of the spies is increasingly to try to track some of these terrorist organizations, militant organizations, which the Pakistanis have been supporting, operating against the Indians, and in some cases, of course, in either Kashmir or in India proper. And, of course, this is another case where the Pakistanis are completely at odds with the United States, and they feel the United States is putting increasing pressure on them in that regard.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, perhaps you're saying that the Pakistani military is basically happy to have the Americans do drone strikes and wage this covert war against the Taliban movement in Pakistan that they deem as a threat to themselves. But once the war starts getting cranked up to the degree that it's actually becoming effective against the insurgency in Afghanistan, and also, of course, the civilian casualties and all that, I'm not discounting that completely because they got domestic political considerations. But it sounds like once the war in Pakistan gets so effective that it starts helping the American side in the war in Afghanistan, that's when the Pakistanis want to call off their help or their permission to let the CIA and the JSOC continue to do this.
Certainly that's one of the factors that is impacting on Pakistani attitudes toward the U.S. Presence in Pakistan. It's clearly not just one factor. It's a combination of things,
mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to judge exactly how they weigh the Afghan Taliban aspect of this versus the killing of civilians. And by the way, not just ordinary civilians, but in many cases, and most recently in mid-March of this year, the tribal elders of areas in the northwest region of Pakistan, which means that basically the community leadership in these areas are being killed by these drone strikes. And by the way, these are people who are perfectly willing to live and let live with the Pakistani government. These are not people who are up in arms against the Pakistani government, but people who have either made their peace with the Pakistani military or who've made it known that they're willing to do so. And so one of the issues here, as my friend, the specialist on Pakistan at King's College, has told me the Pakistanis are really have lost their confidence that the United States has any judgment whatsoever about who to target in Pakistan, and they're very worried about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as well they should be. If the question is, do the Americans know who to target when they're firing off their Hellfire missiles? There's plenty of indication that no, mostly they don't, which makes me want to ask. I don't want to spend too much time on Afghanistan because I want to switch over to Iraq here. But I wonder, after all these years of fighting, 9.5 years really of war in Afghanistan, does Hamid Karzai control anything more than a few city blocks of Kabul at this point still? Is there anything like a nation-building exercise actually happening in Afghanistan?
Well, that depends on whether you mean a formal exercise versus the reality of it. Obviously, the U.S. and NATO are claiming that they're involved in a nation-building exercise. That's part of the official doctrine of the war in Afghanistan. The reality is that they're no closer to building a nation than they were before they started. I would argue that they're even farther away from that, in fact.
I mean, really, with this guy, Karzai, they might as well install me in power there as far as how much legitimacy he has to be the ruler of those people. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, Karzai, in terms of the Pashtun population across the south of Afghanistan, really has no credibility or legitimacy because he has done two things. One, he has aligned himself with warlords and local, former jihadists, former activists, generals in the army of the United States put together to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan, who turned out to be just thugs and who raped children and beat up the population and stole their money, their land, and everything else. And so one of the strikes against Karzai is just that he's aligned with the worst elements of the power structure in southern Afghanistan. The other one, of course, is that he has presided over a foreign military presence that has turned out to be a disaster for particularly the Pashtun population of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think probably if everyone just, conjures an image of David Petraeus and repeats 100 times really fast, the surge is working, the surge is working, everything will turn out just fine over there, like it has in Iraq. Which is what we got to talk about now. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Gareth Porter. And another important article that you wrote this week, Gareth, is, again, at antiwar.com/Porter, Maliki's doubts threaten post-2011 Iraq troop presence. So obviously, to break that in pieces here, what post-2011 Iraq troop presence? The deal was we're going to be out of Iraq, every single one of our combat forces, by the end of this year. And then what's this about Maliki's doubts threatening this extended troop presence?
You're referring to the 2008 withdrawal agreement.
The one that George Bush signed.
Which George W. Bush signed with the al-Maliki government. After the al-Maliki regime and al-Maliki personally really shocked the Bush administration and the U.S. military by demanding in July of 2008 that the United States had to get out, whereas the Bush administration had been under the illusion that it was going to have a decades-long presence, military presence in Iraq with access to all those beautiful big bases that they'd built up during the war, which would continue to be a means of the United States projecting power into the rest of the Middle East. Well, al-Maliki had a nice surprise in store for them because he forced them to sign this agreement, which they didn't want to sign. The only reason that Bush signed this agreement, by the way, is that a certain candidate named Obama had won the election or was about to win the election. It was clear what the result was going to be in 2008, in October 2008, and he was afraid that Obama would do something even worse. And so he signed the agreement thinking that it was the lesser of two evils. In any case...
Well, and he didn't really have a choice simply because even if it had been McCain coming up next, Bush had to have something signed before he could leave power, right?
Well, I think that...
And Maliki wasn't giving in. Patrick Coburn said in the spring of 08 that Bush is pushing for 56 bases. Maybe it was 58. I never can remember. And then you know, it was reported over and over throughout that summer that Bush keeps coming back with a lower and lower number, and Maliki will not budge. Maliki insists, out by the end of 2011, no bases, no personnel, no nothing. And Bush right. really had no choice by the end
Bush
of his term.
Bush had no choice. He had to either defile Maliki at some political risk, and also, of course, you know, looking bad with his own public at home, which in 2008 was absolutely opposed to a long-term presence by the United States. So he was in a bit of a fix. But I do think that, you know, had the Obama candidacy not looked like it was going to win, Bush might have tried to stake out an even tougher position. So I think that's part of the storyline. In any case, what we have now is that Obama has caved in once again to the wishes, the interests of the military and the Pentagon, and agreed to a plan to station 15 to 20,000 troops in Iraq, but only on the condition, of course, that Nouriel Maliki makes an official request to the White House by a letter from the Prime Minister. And it's very clear now that Maliki is not going to do that. I would be very, very surprised if before the end of this year there's a letter that goes to the White House requesting those troops to stay. And there are at least three reasons for that. One is that Maliki has actually moved closer to Iran, aligned, I think, even more openly with Iran than he had before on the international politics of the Middle East, primarily because of Saudi Arabia's outrageous aggression in Bahrain, moving troops into Bahrain in order to aid the Sunni monarchy there in putting down violently a Shia majority democratic movement. The Iranians as well as the Iraqis were outraged by that. But Iraq, a Shia majority country, has very clearly aligned itself with the Iranian position against Saudi Arabia and strongly supporting the Shiite majority in Bahrain. And I think this has meant that it would be much more difficult and I think impossible for him to accept the presence of U.S. troops, even though he might feel that it would be in his interest in some other respects in order to protect him from the possibility of a renewal of Sunni insurgency and even possibly a war against the Kurds. But the Iraqi military, by the way, is very intent on having U.S. troops stay there for precisely that reason. And I'm not at all sure that Maliki is going to survive 2011 because it's very possible that he might be overthrown by the Iraqi military with the good wishes, of course, of the U.S. military. But there's another reason, of course, and that is there's another reason that Maliki is not likely to make that request, and that is that Muqtada al-Sadr is back. His movement is still very strong, once again very strong, particularly in the south. And al-Maliki needs him. He's accepted him as a partner in the government. Muqtada al-Sadr controls 40 seats in the Iraqi parliament, and that those 40 seats are extremely important to al-Maliki's position as prime minister. And should he make the request, it's very clear that Muqtada al-Sadr's movement will try to unseat Nouriel Maliki. So,
well, why is that very clear?
Well, because of particularly recently there have been some major demonstrations by the Sadrists in which they have read statements by Muqtada al-Sadr from Iran stating very clearly that they will not accept any request for American troops. American troops must leave before the end of this year. If the troops stay, then they will go on the warpath once again. Mm-hmm. And they have not stated explicitly that they're going to unseat al-Maliki, but that is certainly certainly implicit in that set of circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when you talk about the reverberation of what Saudi Arabia is doing in Bahrain right now in Iraq and the import that that has for the future of the region, it reminds me of the WikiLeaks, and I have to go back to them, where King Abdullah says to the Americans, I can't understand why you would get rid of Saddam Hussein. The policy has always been, it's you and me and him against the Iranians to contain that Iranian revolution. And now really all that George Bush and Dick Cheney did was reverse the policy of Ronald Reagan and import that Iranian revolution to Iraq, which is not, you know, completely under the thumb of the Iranians, but clearly it's in their orbit. And as you say, as everybody in the region is watching King Hamad Khalifa in Bahrain with the help of the Saudis put down the Shiite majority there, and knowing that the Americans are in on all of that all along as well, that only pushes them closer and closer to Iran. So that's I guess right, it really is going to come down to whether or not there's a coup d'etat in that country and which way they're going to go.
My main source on what the United States was planning in Iraq to keep 15 to 20,000 troops, again, of course, only on the proviso that al-Maliki makes an official request. My official, my source in the Iraqi intelligence service on this has told me that the Americans, from the Iraqi point of view, have completely underestimated the significance of this Saudi move to the international politics of the region. I mean, they did not understand that this is going to alienate very seriously the Shiite government in Iraq and push it closer to Iran. And this, I think, is just one more indication of the cluelessness of the U.S. government with regard to Iraq, the degree to which it has continued to live in a sort of wonderland of sort of wishes and dreams, rather than basing its policy on objective reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I wonder when it comes to Kurdistan, it seems like if they're going to be able to get anybody to invite them to stay at all, I think you indicate in your article they're working on trying to entrench the 3rd Infantry Division up there. Our current Secretary of State, Obama's opponent in the primaries, Hillary Clinton, said, well, we've got to at least keep air bases there for the long term. And I guess I wonder, with all these competing interests, can we basically just flip a coin to try to figure out which side America will be on if Iraq and Kurdistan go to war over Kirkuk?
Well, I mean, I think that if, you know, if what I'm suggesting in my article is correct, that the United States is not going to support anybody, we're not going to be in a position to be a major factor in that. You know,
assuming it doesn't happen till after next December, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's going to happen this year. Although, you know, it's possible that that there may be efforts by certain people in the Iraqi power structure to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not out of the question. But barring a coup d'état in Iraq, I would not look for the United States to be involved in a war there. But nevertheless, that is still a possibility because of the instability, the uncertainty of what is going to happen to the al-Maliki regime. You know, one thing that we can certainly count on about Iraq is that it's going to remain unstable for years to come.
All right, everybody. That is the heroic Gareth Porter, independent historian and journalist for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net, and we run all of it at antiwar.com/Porter. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me again, Scott.
All right, everybody, and that's the show for today, Anti-War Radio. We're here every Friday from 6:30 to 7 on KPFK. Check out the archives of the show at antiwar.com/radio and at scotthortonshow.com. More than 1,800 interviews going back through the years for you there. And one more time, check out Gareth Porter's articles at antiwar.com/Porter. Pakistan moves to curb more aggressive drone strikes and spying, and Maliki's doubts threaten post-2011 Iraq troop presence. Thanks again to Gareth and for all y'all to listen. For listening. See you next week.